I want to start with a sort of a disclaimer. The outline that I had made actually had three paragraphs, and only the most controversial one actually got published, the first paragraph. And what I want to say up front is that what I'm talking about is not anything particularly special. It's just an aspect of human experience, and I've been studying Tai Chi, which kind of gets at some of it. But I know that in Agilent Labs there's people who do all kinds of music, people who paint, people who are brilliant mathematicians, people who get at this state which I want to discuss in very many different ways. And what I hope to do is take sort of my explorations and try to bring back an engineering model of what I think is going on in the mind, and to maybe encourage other people to take whatever their area of expertise is and come back and share with us what you find gives value and interest and meaning to life. And it may just be my own kind of projection, but I kind of feel like there's a little bit of a social thing about, oh, well, you should keep that separate from business. That's not really something that relates to business. And I'd like to kind of try to expand that boundary and break it down just a little bit, because I think that what we need to do is bring those things which we do in private, the things which make us feel good about life, and figure out how to infuse those into business. And I think it'll be good business, actually. So this is a title, and I'm kind of inspired by some of the world's problems that I see, and you all know what they are, big long laundry lists of things that we all wish we could have some impact on. And then I think back at this quote from Einstein, that we can't really solve the problems that we've created by using the same kind of thinking that made them in the first place. What was he talking about? And so what I want to get at in this talk is I think that there are two modes, at least two modes of using the mind. And one of them we tend to rely on almost exclusively in our business structures, our political structures, and the way we tend to relate to each other in formal ways. And then the other way is what I think Einstein was talking about, and I'd like to basically touch on that subject and see what that other mode is. So here's sort of the general outline of what I want to talk about. Do you all remember what it was like before the internet exploded, before AOL came online, and before there was this huge influx of new people that had no idea about what the internet was or how to use it, before spam, before... I remember that you could go on to Usenet and you could ask a question about astrophysics or chemistry, and you likely as not would have a Nobel laureate answer you. And what you read on the news groups were actually pretty authoritative, little tidbits of information. You could have really high-level discussions and learn a lot. Then what happened is there was a boom of a population explosion, and people came in faster than the culture could be transmitted to them. So I think that a similar thing happened here with the wisdom traditions. Back when humanity, and this is about 10,000 years ago, back before the agricultural explosion, people went through and developed using language, using symbolic thinking. And then at a certain point in their life, some elder would come over and say, it's time for you to learn about this wisdom thing. Learn about a kind of thinking that does not involve symbols, a kind of thinking where you're related to everything and you don't think about things as being against you, for and against. And it's a kind of non-symbolic kind of thinking, which is what I think Einstein was talking about. What happened, though, is that back in that time, pretty much everyone had someone mentor them into this way of thinking. But then, when the agricultural explosion came in, the population grew too fast for that to work anymore. So what happened is, essentially, people who didn't know taught people who didn't know, and that particular deep way of thinking was lost by and large. However, the various traditions have carried on threads of it. to the present day, and it may be time now, actually, in the human experience, to sort of democratize this stuff and get out these other modes of thinking. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. I'm going to talk about what is consciousness fundamentally, and I think it's similar to a generic model of computation. How do our brains work? And then I'm going to try to do a formal analogy to show how when our minds are operating in this nonverbal mode, they are formally equivalent to a quantum computer. And that sounds crazy, but I'm actually going to try to make it work for you. And then I want to go over some applications of what could be the advantages if we use this other mode of thinking in our brains, our bodies, our businesses, and our biospheres. And is this really feasible? So let's start with the most fundamental, which is there. Before the Big Bang, that's what we had. Before we were born, we didn't have any symbolic consciousness. We just made ourselves. And it was all done in this kind of interconnected way where everything just did what it needed to do wherever it was. But then there was a Big Bang, and then we had the vacuum, and then we had the material popping out of that, and then we were born. And then we had us and them. And what happened is there was a distinction. There was a distinction between this and that. And that's critical. That's part of the growth of how we all got here and what's going on. However, if we stick with that, there's something where there's sort of a negative mode, which is really easy to get stuck in, which is sort of us versus them. And to try to protect us by making the boundaries even tighter and tighter and tighter. However, for things like cells and for actually any kind of a system, I think there's a more mature view, which says semi-permeable membrane, you know, it's actually in homeostasis with the environment. So I wanted to talk a bit about some models that people have for how humans develop. Here's one, Kohlberg's models of moral development, and he talks about pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional. And the reason that conventional stops right here at law and order is because up to this level, it all is based on symbols and logic and laws and algorithms. This one, from here on up, starts to think about nonverbal, starts to think about relationships, starts to think about more of an intuitive understanding of what's going on. Here's another one, Philip Crosby's Five Levels of Maturity. And I would say that most of our businesses, I think, are somewhere back up in sort of these ranges. And so what you get here is that you move up into deep understanding and sort of intuitive mode, and you start to look at things strategically. The reason that we had a big crash, and I'll show you some graphs in the global market, the internet, just recently, the dot-com bomb, people have been calling it, is because we've been looking at near-term results. We've been optimizing for quarterly profits, and we haven't been looking at distant or strategic. And I think that our role as humans on this planet is to make sure that life is around 1,000 years into the future. Someone needs to be looking at this, and our governments aren't doing it, our businesses aren't doing it, and we need to figure out how to get that injected into it. Now, these ideas, these evolutions of concepts, show up in all different areas. So here's some mathematical concepts. It started out early, just the ego, just me. And so this is 1, 2, and 3 in Roman numerals, and 1, 2, and 3 in Chinese. Just there they are, egos laying around. Then eventually we had to admit the existence of not me, and we called it nothing, because of course if it's not me, it must be nothing. Then we talk about interactions of egos, so we can add and subtract them, divide them. Those are rational numbers. That all makes sense. Of course, very rational. Egos interacting. Then we start to think about ourselves. Like, what is actually going on here? So we have a meta-inquiry. Well, if I multiplied these two things, which means I arranged them in an array that was A by A, and there were B in there, then what would A have to be? Self-inquiry. Then we get into irrational stuff. This sign is false. What does that mean? That gets us to the next one, self-referential paradox. A squared equals minus 1. This sign is false. You divide it through and you say, well, A must be a form of unity, but it can't be 1 or minus 1. What must it be? Well, it has to be imaginary. So what we see is that we've kind of been dragged with our heels, pulled into this idea that it's not just us, it's others, and it's not just the simple things, but the self-referential has to make sense too. And you see how they get names that are more and more further out there, irrational and imaginary. But that's what you need to actually do math, to actually make it functional. So in getting into a model of the brain, I'm sorry for some of this background, but I want to kind of explain the concepts so that they make sense when I use them later. To understand something that you see in the world, I think it's very fundamental, by example, to Cartesian coordinates. If this is me, I, and I'm looking at you, I have to have an origin, and I have to have some archetypes. I have to have some modes that I project onto so that you are a linear combination of these things with respect to me. And it doesn't really matter what coordinates or basis vectors you use. You just have to have enough of them that span the space, and then you can describe the outside world. So I think this is very fundamental. Now, in three space, these become vectors. But in general, they can be functions. So a good example of that is time and frequency domains. So to describe an object in reality, you need to define a set of orthogonal basis functions, which you'll use in linear combinations to represent the object, to represent reality. So you project the object onto the basis vectors, analogous to a dot product, and then that describes it. And the extension to a dot product is the inner product. So you take the two functions, multiply them, integrate over the space, and that tells you the projection onto that particular coordinate. So in time domain, we tend to think about reality, time domain, right? But actually, that still is a set of basis vectors. What we're doing is we're using delta pulses as our bases. So if you take the delta pulse and multiply it by this and integrate over the whole thing, you get the value of the function at that instant. This is a philosophy with time as a linear history in which the value of each moment is what's interesting. This projection gives you an exact value at any instant, but says nothing about how the thing is changing. You just know that it's there. You don't know if it's rising, falling. You know nothing about time. The frequency domain, on the other hand, is almost exactly a dual, and these two are subject to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Any two Fourier transform-related things are subject to that. Here, you multiply by a cosine or sine basis function, and you get the spectral component at that frequency. The philosophy here is that time is a cyclical process. It tells you everything about a given cycle, but it tells you nothing about the value, absolutely nothing about the value. So you see the two things are complementary. If we get stuck in running our minds, our businesses, according to one transform only, then we find that certain things are just inconceivable. You can't even imagine them. And so what we need to do is find a set of transforms so that the combination of the two cover all the possibilities. Then we've got much more room to make the thing dance a little bit. The last sort of introductory thing I wanted to talk about is the universe apparently is fractal. Then I'll get into the body of the talk. And here's an example of what fractal means. If you make a sequence with something and its complement, 0 and 1, and then you take that as something and you do it again. So this is the something, and so here it is again, and then this is its complement. See, I reversed them all. So I've done the same thing as the first set, something and its complement. Well, here's the something and here's its complement. Now take this as the something and do something and its complement. Then take that as the something and do something and its complement. And you can extend that indefinitely. If you take the spectrum of that sequence, it's 1 over F. The frequency response is 1 over F. And that is pervasive all over the place. The voltages, currents, and resistances in electronic devices have 1 over F, and they've been measured out to years, the spectral components. Galactic noise has that. Annual seasonal temperature and rainfall. Internet traffic volume shocked everyone a few years ago when they did measurements and said, wait a minute, the Internet is fractal. Economic data, both the loudness and pitch of music. What this means, actually, is that the universe, at a very fundamental level, is self-similar. It keeps doing the same thing over and over again at all scales. And that's very powerful because it means that if we understand something about one of these components at one scale, there's a good probability that we can apply it to other scales. So fractals imply metaphor. So what I'd like to do is develop several metaphors now that shed some light on how the brain operates, how businesses are organized, how planetary ecology operates. So let's start right in with what is computation? And this is maybe a little bit controversial. It's a different way of looking at computation. what I'd like to define computation as is it's simply a re-transforming of the data into another set of basis vectors. Remember garbage in, garbage out? So basically, there is nothing in the output of the computer that is not already implicit in the data. Nothing new has been developed. We've just projected it into a new space, and that's what we call the answer. Classical computers actually throw away a lot of the information so that you actually can't derive the data from the answers. But it is possible to build a reversible algorithm in which all the information is preserved, and then this becomes actually mathematically a coordinate transform from one basis to another. And what's interesting about this is that if we're transforming from one basis to another, what's implicit in one representation may be hidden in the other one, and vice versa. So making this computation actually gets us some new information that was hidden before in the data. Now, what is consciousness? I think it's something similar. Oh, I wanted to say the example here. For instance, if you have an integer, all the factors of it are implicit in the integer. And a computer may figure that out, and it may take years of computer time to figure it out, but it actually was implicit in there. So you've just changed the representation from integers into lists of factors. So what is consciousness? I think that self-awareness involves at least two coordinate systems, and then some kind of a reversible transform that makes sure that this coordinate system is coherent or consistent with that other coordinate system. And you kind of mirror this thing back and forth. And you'll see that this is actually similar to the way a quantum computer works, and I'll show that. So let's talk about sort of the two ways. I think that those two domains in the mind are what people have popularly called left brain and right brain. And they ideally are kept in sync by exchanging information across the hemispheres. So left brain, right brain, rational, intuitive, ego-based, non-ego. This is the one that says it's us versus them, and this one says, no, we're actually all related. This one operates very similar to the particles or the delta pulse basis vectors. This one operates on relationships or waves. Classical quantum. These two modes arrive from deep structures in consciousness, self-awareness, and they show up at many different levels. One thing that got me interested in thinking about this was a Barney Oliver symposium in which Carver Mead came and talked about the nature of consciousness. And he said something which stuck with me for a long time, which is Boolean symbolic von Neumann algorithms simply will not work if they run on human wetware. Our brains don't run fast enough. They don't have enough neurons. They can't possibly play chess at the level that a computer plays it. But we know that Kasparov was actually not beaten until computers were evaluating 200 million moves per second. He was doing something in his head that was almost up to 200 million moves per second, then he was beat. Actually, he says that he just lost his edge because he won the first game, the second game he got rattled, he lost, and then that caused him to lose the third game. So we really don't really know if this is a strong boundary. In addition, the game Go has a much larger combinatorial space, and there are no computers that play better than a basic beginning level, intermediate level of Go. So what does the brain do that gets it up to this kind of performance for people who have actually developed this culture? How do we encourage more of this, and how do we apply it to our businesses and organizations? A little more background. You might be familiar with volumetric holographic storage. So here's just a sort of a quick primer on it. Basically, you can take an image and interfere this coherent image with a reference beam, and it produces an interference pattern which you can then store in a crystal. And then later on, you can take this crystal, which has index variations in it, and you can read it by putting in another reference beam, and it reproduces the wavefront of the original symbol. So what you can do is you can store, say, 1,000 different bits in a spatial modulator, store them at a given angle in this crystal, and then you can read them out by adjusting the angle of the crystal, and people have stored gigabytes, many, many gigabytes of information, and you index it by changing the angle. The brain does a similar thing to store information. Let's look, before we kind of get into what the model is, at how neurons operate. These are some latest, fairly recent results. This is a Scientific American, quotes from a Scientific American article. Each neuron connects with hundreds of other neurons through synapses. So this is a neuron bulb, and these are synapses which connect to other neurons. That makes this neuron a member of several communities, you see, because it gets some email from there and some email from there, and it's also a member of that list and a member of this list, something like that. Synapses can be either inhibitive or excitative, and it appears that adjacent synapses are multiplicative rather than additive. Timing is critical. This is a recent result that people didn't know before. Over large areas, the triggering time of these things is coherently controlled to about a millisecond. And both forward and backwards propagation occurs in the nerves, in the synapses. So here's my little sketch of sort of how this looks. This is a piece of the brain. And this is the sensory input coming in from whatever senses happen to be active, say from the retina. So what we're looking at now is a single point. And then this is some slice inside the brain of a bunch of nerves. And you can see that the synapses, there's two different communities here. There's the green community and the red community. You see how they all share connections? Now, if you happen to be looking at not just one point, but you happen to look at two points, then the timing of these pulses would interfere like this, so that inside the brain you would see regions that were higher activation and lower activation due to coherent and incoherent addition of these propagating waves. Now, if the two points are further apart, then this spacing will match the red community, and it'll fire. It'll go, I know what that is. Those are two dots separated by that. And if it's a little bit closer, then it will coherently map to, see, this is the multiplication of two functions, which is why I was telling you the inner product is to map into an archetype. This would then excite the green one. It would go, I know what that is. Those are two points a little bit further apart. Now, this is not limited to points. It could be any given shape. It could be a transform of the letter R or the letter L. It could be recognizing a human face, for instance. So, Here's some research results from some people at Caltech. Here we've directly investigated neuronal substrates of visual recall by recording from single neurons in the human medial temporal lobe while the subjects were asked to imagine previously viewed images. They had them look at Van Gogh's sunflowers, and they actually had some probes. There's people that were undergoing surgery for tumors, and they actually have to map how the brain's working so that they can cut appropriately to get at the tumors. So it's no one was harmed. So they had them looking at Van Gogh's sunflowers, and they noticed that, yeah, this region, that's the one that's being excited. Then they had the subjects close their eyes and think about the image. And what they found is that 88% of the sites that they found were stimulated were also stimulated when the person was thinking about the sunflowers. So we appear to use the same structures to recognize features as we do to think about things. Which leads to this. This is symbolic thought. This community talks to that community. If the green community fires, it launches waves like that. If the red community fires, it launches waves like that. And then these two portions of the brain just, you know, they talk back and forth. It's kind of like jungle drumming. Boom, 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 boom. And so we end up with the symbolic mind, which is taking concepts, and each concept is related to a linear combination of archetypes, and the archetypes are actually embedded holograms inside the mind. Some disadvantages to this. The sensory input is not involved anymore. This is kind of off in its own space. And so you end up with a picture of the nerd who's so into his mind that, you know, he's at a party and he's knocking things over. That's sort of a picture. And there are other neural centers. About 5 years ago, there was some research that came out that showed science has gotten so broken into different camps that a lot of the interesting stuff is actually at the boundaries. And so a fellow that was a specialist in neuroanatomy happened to take a course in gastroenterology and looked at some cross-sections of stomachs. And he went, oh, my gosh, this thing's made out of neural tissue. And so they actually found out that the stomach has more neurons in it than the brain. And so when someone has a gut feeling, they really do have a gut feeling. So in the Chinese system, actually, there are three worlds. There's this world, which is sort of mental, and this one, which is emotional. And then from here down is maybe more instinctive. And they talk about two gates. There's a gate here at the pelvis, and there's a gate here at the neck. And if you can relax, no tension. The principle is that tension stops the propagation of intelligence because it creates noise and it decoheres the wavefront. If you can stop doing this self-excitation here, this bouncing back and forth, then other neural centers in the body can participate in the shared experience, paying attention to what's going on. That's a little controversial, I know, but I think that's the way it works. Okay, so let's look at one more thing that kind of feeds into this. Wave or particle. We all know about the two-slit interference problem here. I think I have a pointer. Where you launch, in this case, an electron. And you launch it towards two slits, one at a time. And what you find is that the two slits interfere, just like that drawing I made of the two wavefronts making an interference pattern, and you get this thing. Now, if you go, no, how can that be? It was a single electron. How could it go two places at the same time? So you go, I'm going to figure out what's going on here. I'm going to put a laser here, and you actually can get backscatter off a single electron in a detector. And if the electron goes through this one, I'll know it. Turns out if you set that up, you get two lumps. The electron either goes through one hole or the other, no longer interferes. It's lost its omniscient superluminal connectivity because measuring it decoheres the field. So what's going on here is that in this other one, and this shows sort of the two modes of the mind. Now, see, it would be possible for this input to propagate through and for these communities not to be hair-triggered and go, we're not going to fire. We know that those are two points that are here, but we'll just leave that be for a while. Then those waves can propagate back, and other holograms get a chance to decide something about it. But as soon as these guys go, know what that is, and they go, boom, you know, we know what it is, they've decohered. They've forced this into one classical state. They forced it into exactly what the hologram said it was. We know that this decays exponentially in amplitude. So if this fires, it overrides whatever was coming in beforehand. So when we decide that we know what's going on, that destroys any further chance to get a deeper understanding of it. No one else can get involved because this one decided to say what it was. So just some general features about this theory, this kind of model. This automatically, if you talk about something which recognizes things based on propagating interference patterns in the brain, it automatically recognizes things with bilateral symmetry. If you have a bilaterally symmetric image on the retina, you will get coherent addition for anything along a sagittal plane, where the two coherent things end up summing together. The energy piles up in a plane. This is brilliant for recognizing life. All higher forms of life are bilaterally symmetric. So if you just wire up the simple hologram saying, if I see power along the central line, it's alive, I better pay attention to it. You get that automatically with this algorithm. Images with circular symmetry, a Fresnel ring, focuses energy even more tightly into a central spot. That is a match filter to the human breast. So a child, without having to learn anything, automatically gets, I know what life is, and I know where I'm going to get my food. It's sort of co-evolved. It's really nice. And then propagated interference patterns at the Fourier plane are magnitude invariant to any kinds of shifts. So once you know the letter R, you'll recognize it no matter where it is in your field. You get that automatically with this system. As kind of an aside, I want to demonstrate something about the dynamics of how this works. I proposed, this is an old slide, 1996, that we build a little holographic display. And the idea was to put a little piece of silicon on your glasses and drive that with the Fourier transform of an image. And what's nice about this is that there's no lenses at all. You have a little LED. It shines on a piece of silicon, which is coated with electro-optic material. And you actually encode an amplitude-only hologram, shine an LED on it, and you look out in space and you see through this piece of silicon the image. The eye does the Fourier transform and you see the image on the retina. It's nice because there's no lenses, nothing at all. It could weigh, tenth of an ounce. You just have some kind of a, something coming down to a little computer on your belt. And it would work like this. And the image would, here's the little coherent thing. The eyeball looks through the piece of silicon and sees the virtual CRT. And what you do is you put this interference pattern, a quantized version of it, on the piece of silicon. You look through it, and then you see the three pixels. The problem is, the only techniques that we have now to do this kind of a thing involves can only either do amplitude or can only do phase. You can't do phase and amplitude. And when you do a Fourier transform of the image, you get both phase and amplitude. So we really don't know how to do it. We need to solve an approximation problem where we come up with phase or amplitude only. And it turns out in the literature there's an algorithm for efficiently doing that, and it's like this. So this is a little simulation I did. If you start with... Sorry that the colors didn't come out real well. If you start with a random distribution and you multiply it by a weighting mask of the image that you want to actually produce, and then do a Fourier transform of the two things multiplied, here you have amplitude and phase. Quantize it to either phase or amplitude only. Backwards propagate it, multiply by the mask, iterate back and forth, backwards, forwards, backwards propagate. And what happens is you end up with, in this case, it's a four-phase only, 0 pi, 3 pi over 2, and 2 pi, or whichever way, quadrature. And you end up with a stable image, which is what you'd see with the LED. In the literature, this algorithm has been widely known over a large class of images to converge in 5 or 6 iterations. So let me show you how this works in the brain. There's a fellow named Benjamin LeBay, and he's another one of these guys sticking probes into people's brains undergoing tumor surgery. And he found some interesting things. If you told a person to wiggle their finger, you say, wait a random time and then wiggle your finger, and you look at the signal, you find out that there's a precursor. The person decides that they're going to wiggle their finger, and as soon as they decide, they think that they made the decision now. But actually, inside the brain, we know the decision was actually starting about a second earlier, but the person is unaware of it. So now here's some other tricky things. What he did is he put a stimulus on the skin, and he was able to put a stimulus in the brain. The probes are bidirectional. So if he stimulated the skin here, then he would notice that the person immediately recognized it. If he... stimulated inside the brain at the same point where the hologram is, and he only did it for a half a second, the person wouldn't know it. They didn't perceive anything happen. But if he stimulated the person's brain for more than half a second, then the person would, after a half second delay, say, yes, I recognize that. It takes a half second for them to recognize the direct stimulation of the brain. So then he also did this. He stimulated the skin, and then he started to stimulate the brain. You would think that this would be recognized immediately, but actually the stimulation of the brain masks it because this iterative... well, I'll explain why in a minute. This is getting complicated, so let me just tell you, cut to the chase rather than trying to analyze it for you. You can read in the references. The conclusion that he came to is that egoic consciousness, building a model of reality in terms of words and saying, oh, that's a chair, that's... Someone brings you blindfold in a room, pulls a blindfold off. How long does it take you to realize what's going on? It's a half second. It takes a half second to make a willful act from symbolic mind. And in waking state, the brain is operating systolically at about 12 hertz. That's what you measure. If you just put scope probes right here, you see a 12 hertz cycle. If what we're doing is we're iterating between the hologram and the senses, back and forth, try to find a stable representation such that the internal model will produce the sensory input, reproduce it. 6 iterations at 12 hertz is half a second. It's entirely consistent with LeBay's measurements. And you can prove this to yourself. I mean, you may be skeptical. What do you mean a half second delay? Do this experiment. Go out in a field, someplace that's soft, and sit on a bicycle. And you can ride it. Everyone can pretty much ride because they learned, their body learned how to do it non-symbolically when they were a child. But now let's think about, let's try to figure out a way in which we could ride it where the mind had to be involved. And one way to do that is just simply cross your hands. Now you can start, before you do this, you can think, well, let's see, I'm going to have my hands crossed, so if the bike goes this way, then I have to push this one forward. And if the bike goes that way, then I have to push this one forward and get it all figured out. You get on a bike, you go like this, you'll fall over. I guarantee it. It's because it's a feedback system. It's a closed-loop feedback system. And the time constants involved are such that a half-second phase lag in the closed loop causes it to be unstable and oscillatory. It puts the poles over on the other side of the plane. Another thing which you can sort of play is Mahjong, and there's a game under Linux called Shishen Cho, which is kind of fun. You have all these things, which are all different weird shapes, Chinese letters and dragons and things. And the game here is that you find any two which can be connected by three lines, and you go click, click, and then they disappear. And then you find two more. Where are some? Here. Click, click, and they disappear. And then you go click, click, and then they disappear. And naively, when someone starts to play this game, they'll go like this. This is what I did anyway. They go, let's see, green oak tree. Are there any green oak trees? Okay, I didn't find that. What about the funny purple thing with gray line? No, the purple thing with a hook. Purple things with hooks. And what you find is that it just doesn't work. You can take 20 minutes to solve this thing. And then if you keep playing with it, eventually you get to a point where you go, oh, just look at it. And you go, boom, 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 boom. And there's no words going on. And the difference between those two, you can play with it in half an hour, you can prove this to yourself. The difference between using words and not using words is at least an order of magnitude. And you can get that within an hour of playing around with it. You get rid of that half-second delay. Okay, so now I'd like to sort of make the formal comparison to quantum computation. And this is hard. I'm going to have to do three or four slides, tutorial slides, to sort of make this make sense. So please bear with it. Quantum states, well, classical systems operate on zero and one in mutual opposition. Classical computation is in that us versus them egoic realm. It's either a zero or it's a one, and I'm going to know which it is right now. Quantum states, on the other hand, operate on wave functions in which zero and one are different bases. They're different dimensions. They're not in opposition to each other. They both exist simultaneously in different weighted summations. So this says that the wave function is a linear combination, alpha times the zero basis vector and beta times the unity basis vector. So this is the classical zero and one. But here they exist as a linear combination. And so we could think of these, and in the rest of the slides, I'm going to assume that this is real and this is complex, so that a quantum qubit, this is not fully general, but a quantum qubit in terms of what I'm going to present is actually just a complex number. And the degree it's pointing here or there is it's a zero, and the degree it's pointing here or there, it's a one. And it can take on any linear combination. So we end up with quantum gates, if you look at how quantum computation works. In the classical system, you just have this and its complement, and everything's very well defined. In a quantum system, you have a linear combination on the input, and you have some, it's called a unitary transform of it on the output. So in this case, I simply swapped the real and imaginary components. In this case, I changed the sign. I made a complex conjugate. In this one, I created a entangled state where I have I've basically taken these two and rotated everything by 45 degrees. So you can express the functionality of these gates as a matrix. So you have A and B on the alpha and beta on the input, and you have some coefficients in the matrix, and that tells you what they get converted to on the output. Okay, you can do any matrix you want, subject only to the constraint that the probability that it's either a 1 or a 0 has to equal 1, because it has to be one or the other once you try to measure it. And this implies mathematically that the matrix must be unitary, so that the matrix times its adjoint equals the identity matrix. One thing I want to point out, well, I'll show this on the next one. So let's look at a more complicated gate that has two inputs and two outputs. The thing about a quantum gate is that it does not lose any information. You can always compute the input from the output. You have to carry through enough information so that you can figure out what the input was from the output. And I think this might be too complicated to explain in detail, and it's not really necessary. But if this is 0, 0 on these two lines, then the probability of that is alpha of the first one times alpha of the second one. If it's 0, 1, then it's alpha of the first one and beta of the second one. And so you end up with all the classical states, and then they get multiplied by the unitary transform of the gate, and then that tells you what alpha and beta are on the output. The thing about quantum computation is that if you had k variables, say I wanted to build a computer to factor a 100 binary digit number, this matrix is 2 to the k. 2 to the 100, if I had a 100-bit number, this is 2 to the 100. It's inconceivably large, but a quantum system figures that all out immediately. That's the exponential speed-up that you get in a quantum system. It looks at all the possible combinations simultaneously and finds a solution. I'm sorry that the trail is so long, but it's as short as I can make it. And this will come back and make sense, I hope. So here's the gate that I'm going to show you some simulations of, and I'm going to make an analogy back to how the brain works. This is a Toffoli gate, and it has three inputs, A, B, and C, and the outputs are the same as the input, except if inputs A and B are 1, then you swap, you complement C. It turns out that if you've made a gate like this, it satisfies the matrix is unitary, it's its own inverse, and you can always compute the input from the output. It's bidirectional. There is no flow of time in it. No information is lost. And if you hook it up in these special ways, you can make a NAND gate, an XOR gate, or you can create a fan-out of logic signals. So this is known to be a gate which is universal. Anything that we know how to do in computation, you can do with this gate. So if we figure out how to implement that, we can do anything that computers can do. So I want to say that these unitary quantum gates work like this. I already mentioned a matrix. And if you write that out, the flow diagram looks like this. This goes to here, and I have some certain weights. Free space propagation of light, sound, also follows the same law. You end up with this, and then a certain phase angle because of the propagation delay difference. This would be the two inputs and the two outputs. And you see we have the same kind of mathematics as this one. Microwave optical combiner does a similar thing. And the brain does a similar thing because it's analogous to this coherent propagation of information, like this. You see? So the neurons pulse regularly in a systolic way. And if the distances match, then you get coherent information so that enough of these arrive at the same time to push you over a threshold. If they arrive out of phase, then you get two pulses which don't go over a threshold. So this ends up doing a very similar thing. Even with a simple stimulus, neurons will indeed gradually be corralled into a working network like a stone generating ever wider ripples. Even a simple light shown in the direction of a cat will, as a stone in a puddle, activate an assembly of an estimated 10 million neurons within its outer perimeter within a quarter of a second. What is more, the degree of activity of a neuron assembly decays exponentially as the leading edge spreads out. So what I want to say here is that these holograms talking to holograms are unitary transforms. You can compute the input from the output. It's just forward Fourier transform, backwards Fourier transform. They satisfy the definition in all aspects of a quantum gate. Except they're classical. They're not quantum. But they satisfy at least that part of the math. So how could we think? How does Kasparov do 200 million moves per second? Is there a mode in the brain which gives us this exponential speed-up, where we look at all the possibilities simultaneously, and the optimum one pops out? So here's sort of a broad overview of how I think that works. You set up in your mind boundary conditions. This is what I've got to work with, and this is where I want to get to. And then each of these nodes is a hologram that you've learned about engineering. Well, it could be differential. It could be single-ended. It could be this. It could be that. It could be all of these things. And this is you have to find a path through this tree of possibilities. And we've all made flowcharts saying, well, I could do this. I could do that. And then we try to rate them and then prune things off and try to get it down. I think what Kasparov is doing is you set these things up and you don't parse them in a classical way. You don't say, well, it has to be either this or that, and then just take one branch. What you do is you let it be both at the same time. You set them all up. You learn about the field. You learn all the possibilities. And you think about it all at the same time. And what happens, rather than going by either or, you work with a yes and, a superposition. And as you start to increase the gain and let this thing sit for a while, what happens is that the path through here, which actually is the solution to the problem, has no destructive interference. Everything satisfies all the conditions all the way through. And if you turn the gain up a little bit, eventually it will laze, something analogous to lasing, between those two boundaries. And you will have found the global solution, which looked at combinatorial complexity way beyond what could possibly be solved by a Boolean search of all the possibilities. It gets out of control really fast. But if you do it in this way, then you can span a much wider space. So I want to show you a simulation of a quantum system that uses classical analogs of the brain that actually solves a problem like this. And so what I want to do is this simple little logic problem. It's a classical gate, A and B, and here's the output, and I'm going to do, it's a half adder. So this is the sum of the two bits, and this is the carry of the two bits. And in quantum mechanics, you can't have a fan-out unless you do it with a gate, so that these two fan-outs become these two gates, and here's A and B, the input variables. And then I've implemented these two with Toffoli gates, like this, like I showed on the previous slide. And then this is the truth table of what I want to simulate. Here's the algorithm. What I do is for each unitary gate that has an input, a complex input, X and Y, I propagate at each time step. I propagate this input according to the unitary transform and sum a scaled version of it into this node. So this now becomes a linear combination of those two. Then I propagate this one by the backward transform and sum it in over there, the adjoint matrix of U. And then on the next time step, I treat this as X and Y and keep on going. What this does is it says, we have two entities, the input and the output of the gate, and they're having a conversation. Someone says, on one side, someone says, well, what I've got is not consistent with what you've got. Let me propagate back the error and let that modify what you think is going on. And then they go, well, I took your error, and it still isn't consistent with what I'm getting from this other one, so I'm going to send you some of the error, and I'm going to send you some of the error. So this thing anneals itself by no one making a hard decision, but by passing what isn't working to their nearest neighbors and letting the whole thing kind of anneal until everyone's satisfied.
Just like
Agilent. Hopefully it's like Agilent, yeah. Let's see. So then, after I've let this thing kind of stabilize a little bit, I increase a sigmoidal forcing function, which makes these things go to classical states. And that's like a quantum measurement. It forces it into a zero and one state. No longer a complex variable. It has to snap to one of the coordinate axes. So here's the simulations. Set the inputs, read the output. So I set 0 and 1 on A and B. Then you see that there's this equilibration where information is exchanged. Then I force the turn on the forcing function, everything becomes classical, and the outputs become the right thing. Now let's do it the other way around. It's bidirectional, so you can work the problem from any direction. You know, that's a classical creativity tool. If you can't work it this way, try to work it the other way. The system might actually be more stable if you try to run it backwards. So here I set the two outputs, 1 and 0, sum and carry, here and here. And then notice this one's going in the wrong direction for a moment. And then as I start to force it, as these start to take on more classical states, the coherent interference forces that one, which was going in the wrong direction initially, to stabilize, and I get the right answer in this gray region.
So you had a metastable state?
Yes, yes. Now, when people are in waking state, they're running their mind like a Pentium. They're by and large doing symbolic processing. Let's see, what was I doing? I was going to go to the store, and then after I go to the store, they're talking to themselves. And the best way to get the most computation out of that is to increase the clock rate. So we run 12, 13, 14, 15 hertz. Maybe in traffic we're running 15 hertz. When someone meditates, when you look at what Kasparov is doing, he's down around 4 or 5 hertz. He's in the meditative state. And that is how long this systolic quantization mode is. Does it take a long time? Do you give it a long time to find the answer, or do you just force it to make a quick, simple, raise the clock rate up, 1.5 gigahertz Pentium? So this is the same one where I set the outputs and read the input, but I force the quantization to be faster. And so this one, which started off, you remember initially started off in the wrong direction? I forced the quantization so fast that information could not get propagated back. As these started to converge, it wasn't able to feed back and cause that one to change. So it just goes in the wrong direction. I forced the decision too fast, and now it's non-optimal. it's actually not even a state that's in the truth table. It just is not even self-consistent. So then I want to show this one, which is kind of fun. Set one input and one output, and see if the other ones will do the right thing. It's completely bizarre, because there are no inputs or outputs. There's just data, and it's all transforms of itself. So it turns out that on the first forcing function, it makes the wrong error. But it's kind of changed its value so that on the second cycle in this gray band, it actually gets the correct answer. It's pretty neat. So here's the summary of this thing. The classical mode treats me and the other, treats the values of the computation as mutually antagonistic, and it must be one or the other, black and white. Quantum computation treats them as just other modes. I mean, it's not me versus you. We're both kind of together in this thing, and we're trying to find an optimum. In kind of summarizing this particular section, and how am I doing? Boy, I'm... if you look in a textbook on quantum computation, they'll give you this kind of an outline. First thing you have to do is choose an atomic system, and I think it doesn't actually have to be atomic. It can be classical. Choose a quantum system for computation, metaphorically map the problem into the dynamics of it, set the initial state, perform the unitary evolution, read the final state, and then you have to check the results with a classical computer because it sort of probes the space and sometimes you get the wrong answer. This is like instructing the mind, filling it with information. That's a rational process. Contemplation, revelation, that's an intuitive process. That's where the creativity comes. Verification with the rational. So I'm not talking about a revolution where we all become non-rational intuitives. What I'm talking about is something where these two are working in harmony, where we have both modes coming on. And we get the depth of the intuitive, and we check it with what we know how to do using the classical. Wait a minute. I thought that you couldn't get quantum speed up with a classical process. Well, in one of the recent science newses, Ian Walmsley reported that he had, I won't read it to you, but he actually built a system using classical interference of light to get quantum speed up by doing a database lookup. And so some theoreticians, David Mayer, had proposed, had not proven, but had proposed that classical interference could give you this kind of speed up. Heretofore, we thought that you had to be atomic scale, and it had to be all this weird, very delicate stuff. Now we know, he's actually built a system that you can do it with classical interference, which is what we got going on in here. So I have some suggestions. Try to make the set of holograms as complete as possible so that every possibility has a branch to go, so that what you have is a complete set of basis vectors to span the space at each level. Defer collapsing the wave function as long as you can to give the best set of probing the spaces. Try not to map things as dualities. Try not to make it just either or. Sometimes the best solution is to have three or four possibilities. Although humans really tend to want to make it very simple. Pay close attention to any information that appears to be at odds with your current world model. That'll help you add some more holograms to make the map even better. Be willing to change yourself and your problem definition to work with what's possible. That's sharing the error function with your neighbor and propagating to find a global optimum. Okay, so applications. Brains, bodies, businesses, biosystems, very quickly. By the time a child can draw more than a scribble, by age 3 or 4 years, an already well-formed body of conceptual knowledge formulated in language dominates his memory and controls his graphic work. Drawings are graphic accounts of essentially verbal processes, at least in children. And essentially verbal education gains control as it gains control. A child abandons his graphic efforts and relies almost entirely on words. Language has first spoiled drawing and then swallowed it up completely. There's a book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain that illustrates this very, very clearly. People who actually haven't studied drawing, when asked to draw a person, will draw a stereotype of a person. When asked to draw a hand, will draw a stereotype of a hand. And has to draw a face, will draw, they're basically drawing their hologram, which is only simple enough to get by. It can't be that complicated. When asked to sketch a drawing of Stravinsky, I think that Picasso did, they'll do something like this. Now, what this fellow did is he draws a stereotype. He drew Stravinsky upside down so that he really couldn't tell what it was. You know, it's a complicated thing. It gets the symbolic mind out of it. It doesn't match any kind of hologram, so he has to just draw the shapes. And when he draws the shapes, it comes out almost photorealistic, if you saw the original drawing, just by drawing it upside down, getting the rational mind out of it, letting the intuitive mind take over. After a seminar, the person who drew this, when they learned to trust the intuitive mode and not rely on just sketching the hologram, drew a hand like that. The person who drew this drew that. Very short time. Basically, all it takes is realizing that this is a trustable thing. This is a worthwhile mode inside our humanness that we can use. Here's another one, ear dancing. The ear was thought for a long time to be a passive Fourier analyzer, that the cochlea had a resonance on it, and then certain hairs would fire, and that would tell you the pitch. Well, in cadavers, and actually this is a model of a rubber thing inside gelatin that was trying to model all the right Rayleigh numbers and everything in the ear, they found out that the Q is so low that you could recognize maybe two notes, three notes. Boom, 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 that's all you could get. What it turns out is that the ear is an active feedback system. It uses regeneration to actually increase the Q. And the ear actually dances with the sound, and there's a culture to it. So someone that has perfect pitch actually has had to go in and train their ear. And in the reading I've done on perfect pitch, and there's actually some success in training people to use perfect pitch, what you actually listen to is the shape of the interference pattern in the brain. You're not thinking pitch, you're thinking, how does that feel? Oh, there's modes in there. And people that do that actually can exhibit 1% accuracy in pitch recognition. It's really amazing. I had a roommate in college who you'd make a squeak. What's that? He'd go just slightly below B flat, two octaves below middle C. You go, oh, you're kidding me. And so you go to the piano and you go, ding. You go, oh, you're right, you're right. And when an ear is ringing, it's actually emitting sound. So what I found in trying to dabble around with music is that if I think of pitches, if I think of the archetype, the hologram of a pitch, I can't figure it out. But if I think more in terms of this vague thing, which I can't describe, it becomes easier to tell what's going on. I already mentioned this balance in the body. In the Chinese view, there's three worlds. And if we adopt a posture that has tension in the spine, then these neural centers can't all participate and work together. Elements from other systems. Finish up fairly quickly here. Pure meditation goes directly at insight into brain function to see that symbol formation is actually a secondary process to this other mode. Meditation on the breath gets directly at the idea that opposing muscle groups, the in-breath and the out-breath, those can be a duality that fight against each other, so that at the moment where you're trying to fill up the lungs, the one that's trying to breathe out refuses to relax. It doesn't want to lose control. And you lose depth of breath. And focusing on that, you can come to the realization that, oh, these two things actually are part of the same dynamic. And then one will relax and allow the other one to take over, and it cyclically goes back and forth. Yoga works in a way on static stretching of opposing dualistic muscles to reduce the conflict between them. So you see this hologram back and forth works in muscle groups. It works in flexor and extensor in addition to what's going on just in the brain. And I won't go through all of those. But if you look at some of the various traditions, in the Taoist model, Taoism is sort of the philosophical origin of this yin-yang thing, which is the two dualities. And the entire philosophy is about understanding how the two opposing things work together. And they say, well, don't cut the primal block. Before anything existed, there's this block of wood, conceptually. And when we think, we cut the block, is what they say in the ancient text. And they say, prefer not to cut the block. Leave it whole. Don't make these decisions if you can avoid it. But if you have to, make sure that you're cutting along the grain so that you can put it back together again. And you haven't just mixed it all up, made scrambled eggs. Hindu model, neti neti, enlightenment is not this, not that. The truth is not found in particulars, but in wholes. A typical Buddhist injunction is find two things in your mind that are in apparent opposition. Meditate on the two until you can see that they're actually one thing. And then make that a thing and find what's in opposition to it and then draw the circle bigger. Sort of leads you back to the one big thing. And then the Christian model, love your brother as yourself, because actually he's a projection of you in disguise. Okay, businesses. I want to talk about the fallacy of unlimited growth. I think this is how we could see that there was going to be a dot-com bust. And I don't want to say, I told you so, but I was talking about it quite a while before it happened, and this is sort of some of the reasoning. Exponential growth, where the rate of change of a quantity is equal to a rate times the quantity. You have more reproductive individuals than you grow at a rate R, according to the fecundity, leads to a solution pure exponential. Real ecosystems, however, and businesses, planets, finite systems, have a carrying limit, K. So you modify the differential equation by just simply putting N over K, so that when you approach K, then the scaling factor degrades the gain of the system. And that leads to the so-called sigmoidal curve, which looks like this. Naive growth, which assumes an infinite, that you can keep going indefinitely, takes off for the stars. True systems, sigmoidal systems in a finite ecosystem flatten out. Now, what would happen if you had a sigmoid where this feedback function has a time lag in it? And this time lag might correspond to the 500 milliseconds of egoic thought, or it might correspond to what I think by analogy at a corporate level is about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. Then what you get is something where instead of stabilizing out, everyone's safe and sound, you end up with overshooting the demand for internet backbone capacity, and then massive layoffs. This hurts. People are really hurt in here. And if you do it badly enough, because the time constant is very long, imagine the ecosystem thermoregulation capacity of the planet. That's a much longer time constant. And you have to be much more delicate with it. It is possible for this system, if the lag is too long, to actually drive to extinction here. Now, does this apply to anything that's real? So let me show you some actual data. This is from the RIAA organization. This is the actual sales of records and the actual sales of cassettes and the actual sales of CDs. If you plot this on what's called the Fisher-Pry transform, if it's sigmoidal, it'll follow straight lines, like Bode plots. And this is what the data looks like. Records, sigmoidally substituted by cassettes, taking over that market. And then cassettes, sigmoidally substituted by CDs. And these are best fit sigmoids, and you can see how well it predicts the data. Just to show you that this isn't a fluke, here's data for canals, railways, roads, airways, and then this particular author is suggesting that there might be a substitution of magnetic maglev vehicles. This is the field that I work in, the Ethernet, and this is worldwide sales of the Ethernet, 10 base, 100 base, 1,000 base, and 10 gigabits per second. You notice that pretty much everyone has been satisfied with 100 base, and that's up here at nearly a billion ports. Is that right? 1 million in thousands, yes. And what's happening is that 1,000 base is being used as trunking for that, so it flattens out an order of magnitude down, and 10 gig is being used as trunking for that, and it flattens out a factor of 10 down. But notice how they're all flattening. They're all following sigmoidal curves. We basically, I think, have built out for this particular period of time the backbone. There's still a good business here. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be in it, but this period of exponential growth where everyone's P-to-E ratios went up like crazy is pretty much over. And what we need to do is find out what the next thing is. That would be another talk. I won't get into that. But if you multiply those volumes by a price model, and so these are actual prices for 10 and 100 base, so I've actually made a very overestimated price model for 10, 100,000, and 10 gig, then you get these are annual revenues. And what I want to point out is that this entire curve for 100 base, which peaked at annual revenue of about $9 billion a year, is only 3 years wide. We built a 10 gigabit link back here somewhere, and the project was canceled because I think that when you have a hierarchical organization where decisions are made at the top level, the person at the top really can only afford, because they're human, to pay attention to, say, 10 things. And they can only afford to pay attention to the 10 things which are at least a $1 billion market. And so when you suggest, when an engineer comes in and says, you know, we built this part for a customer, And they've actually qualified it, and they want to buy 5,000 units. They go, oh, that's just a distraction. And so what happens is they're not interested until this thing has sort of crossed a threshold. Then we have a 2-year design and ramp up in manufacturing, and it's already over by the time we've entered the market. So I think that if we could figure out how to get rid of this 500 millisecond delay, this analog of filtering information up, having it rattle back around, be distorted, come back, and have decisions only made at places where it's very hard to look at all the possibilities, if the community itself was empowered a little bit more, and I don't think that an engineer should certainly be able to spend millions of dollars, but they should be able to make an initial step. And then with peer review, they should be able to follow that up. And then if it seems inconsistent, well, we back it off. But if it looks like that acorn is growing, it might be a tree someday, and we follow it up. Finally, it gets to a level to where we've got a large commitment. That would allow us to get in these businesses very early while they're still taking off. Because our engineers know what's going on in many cases. Okay, now biosystems, and I think this is getting close to the last one here. The solar flux, the daisy world, this is the work by James Lovelock. The solar flux increases 7% every billion years. The sun is continually getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Will eventually turn into a crisp I don't know. Watson and Lovelock proposed a simple model which explained, in some sense, how the temperature of the planet for the last billion years has stayed at 20 degrees on the average, even though the sun is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. How does it do that? The basic model posits two species on the planet, a white daisy, which reflects sunlight, and a black daisy, which absorbs sunlight. Both daisies prefer to have a temperature of 22.5 degrees. However, if you're a black daisy, at a given environmental condition, you'll be hotter than a white daisy. And if the sun happens to be cool, then black daisies will grow better because they're warmer. And if we're past sort of the point where the sun's gotten too hot, white daisies will grow better because they shed the heat better. So here's a little Ox script that I wrote and made some plots and basically implemented the differential equations that Lovelock talked about in his paper. So what you have is the sun is getting hotter. This is the present time, solar flux of 1, and it was 40% back here 8 billion years ago, and it will be twice the intensity 8 billion years in the future. So if you had no life on the planet, the temperature of the planet would follow this line. It would just get hotter as the sun got hotter. If you have daisies, then the temperature follows this red line, and you see it stays nice, 22 degrees, over about a 6 billion year period. And what happens is that it starts out, it's real cold, so basically everything is black daisies and they make the planet hotter because they grow well and they absorb more heat. And then as the sun goes up, the black daisies fade down and the white daisies come up. And you end up with the two working together making a very solid feedback system which stabilizes the planetary temperature. Now, if the black daisies said, if you could talk to black daisies and you said, what's your plan? They said, our plan is to take over the world. We will be the dominant life form on this planet. We will dominate this market. Then it simply would not work. However, if you extend the model to say, well, what if people get involved? Okay, so here's the temperature on a lifeless planet, and here's the temperature where humans have actually built out 20% of the land space, 40% of the land space, 60% of the land space. By the time you've built out 60% of the land space or cut down 60% of the rainforest, you see you've almost lost all of the intrinsic bioregulation capacity of the planet. Now, we could, with some vision, actually change the color of our buildings and actually take over this function, but we're not doing that. We're just degrading the system and not having the wisdom to replace the functionality that we're losing. You see a similar system. If you extend Daisy World with evolutionary biodiversity so that the daisies actually change by interbreeding and they optimize themselves. It turns out that actually there's two kinds of chlorophyll in the world. C3 chlorophyll, which is dark green and tends to grow in places like Europe where it's very wet and cold, and C4 chlorophyll, which is very gray. And so that's actually black daisies and white daisies. We actually have two kinds of chlorophyll and they serve those functions. But if you have a daisy world where you fragment you break things up with roads, and you break things up so that there aren't any large ecosystems that can mutually interbreed. You find that when it's unfragmented, the temperature is constant. When you reach a critical fragmentation to where biological evolution quits working, then the temperature just follows the lifeless planet. Okay, so people might say, you're crazy. How could you bring on this kind of a, and I'll definitely get us within the 90 minutes here. How could you bring on a world in which people are cooperating, a world in which we seek for global optimums, and a world in which we're not acting in an egoic manner trying to fight each other? Well, there's some interesting research that came out. It turns out that in previous times, women were not very much involved in archaeology, so you pretty much got the man's view. But that's changed. So we have a lot of women now in archaeology, and they're giving us a much broader view of what actually the archaeological evidence says. So Rhianne Eisler, in the book The Chalice and the Blade, presents the thesis that in old European culture from 7,000 BCE to 3,500 BCE, the economy was agricultural, sedentary. The habitat was large aggregated villages with no hill forts. The government was distributed. The social structure was egalitarian and matrilinear, peaceful, art-loving. The goddess was a woman. What happened, or what you see in the archaeological history, is that these cities were built in beautiful places, like on the edge of lakes. They didn't have any walls around them. And when you look at the, you dig them up, you find out that the women are buried with the same grave goods as the men. There are no implements of war. Art and music and whatnot, you see frescoes and things. It was a very interesting place. Peaceful. There was a thing called the Kurgan invasion around this period, and that had a different characteristic. Pastoral with the horse, small villages with semi-subterranean houses. It was ruled by chieftains from hills. You know, this calcium thing that we have around up here is like a fort. And what it does is it protects the brain from the chaos in the muscles that would decohere thinking. So there are no muscles in here, and it's protected with dielectric. That's why we tend to fall into the thing of running it all from the hill fort. Patriarchal, patrilocal, based on symbols, warlike, man-creator. And there was a shift. There was a shift in the dynamic. Why did this happen? Well, some research that came out, these are quotes from the National Geographic website. There was basically two regions of high population density around the Black Sea. This is over here, old Europe. This is the pre-Kurgan invasion. And then there was people living actually in the basin of the Black Sea. The Black Sea was a small freshwater lake. And this was coming out of the last glaciation where the temperature was getting higher and higher and higher. And the glaciers were melting. And people lived here, and people lived actually in the Black Sea basin. It was not a Black Sea, just a little lake. What happened is as the temperature rose, let me show you the Noah's flood. As the temperature rose and the ocean level rose because of the melting glaciers, eventually there was a point, it's about 12,000 years ago, 7,000 years ago, the ocean rose to where it started to break through at the Bosphorus Straits. And it hit the Black Sea with 200 times the force of Niagara Falls. This is very thoroughly documented and quite interesting. Each day, the Black Sea rose about 6 inches, and it pushed everyone out. This is like one of the major population centers of the planet. So it's thought now that this is the origin of Noah's flood. So what happened is those people, this is all backed up by archaeological evidence, these people, because they were used to living around a lake and were dependent on irrigation for farming, they migrated up into these mountain ranges following the courses of rivers. As the temperature continued to get higher and higher and higher, eventually this became desert. And these people moved in waves over here. This is what caused the building of the Great Wall of China, was this big diaspora. And they had to resort to warlike practices, and the peaceful prior way that people had been living, maybe using their minds in a different way, turned into much more of a warlike thing. So this has been studied. People at Rand Corporation in the Cold War studied the prisoner's dilemma, and it captures this really well. You have a game where if two people cooperate, this is the payoff. If one person defects on the other one by cheating, then they actually get a payoff, and the other person gets dinged. But if both people defect, then they both get dinged. So what you have is that if you find a population of defectors that comes and starts to interact with a population of cooperators, then war pays. This idea of optimizing self-interest. Now, if you look at this from the ecological view, which we're forced to do now in the modern age because the planet is finite, we've got to make sense of the whole thing. And you sum these two, and you say, well, what is the penalty to the ecosystem? If we cooperate, everything gets better. If we play this warlike game where one person takes advantage of the other, it kind of grinds down. And if both people are playing that game, it's really nasty. So how do you get out of this? It's known that there isn't a rational solution to this if you're stuck in egoic. And I have two more slides. Chaos theorists and cellular automaton researchers have played a game called Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma on a Grid, where each of these squares is playing a repertoire of strategies for prisoner's dilemma. And a popular one is called Tit for Tat, which says, by default, I'm going to cooperate. If you defect on me, I'll defect on you the next time, just sort of as punishment. But then I'll assume you're going to be nice, and I'll cooperate after that. And so what this is you start out with a random seed of perhaps 80 different strategies. Some of them are, I'm just going to do a random thing. Other ones are, I'm always going to defect. I'm going to just get what I can. And then you let it evolve over time, where each person has a certain amount of resources, and as those resources dwindle, some people die. And then their square is colonized by a random nearest neighbor. And so you see that it changes. With this seed, it goes to all these black regions. These are all cooperative strategies. With a different seed, it goes to both green and orange are defector strategies. So what we have, and this has been analyzed, is a chaotic system which, depending on the seed and depending on the intentionality, hopefully, of the people involved, can orbit around a cooperative attractor in phase space or can orbit around a defector attractor in phase space. And if you graph those in terms of goodness to the ecosystem, this is a deeper null, but a deeper attractor. But if we're stuck over here, it might take a while to get over there. And I think if, as we start to degrade the ecosystem, this activation region will either go to here, or I think we're going to crash the thing. So I think there is some hope. And I think there's even some real-world examples of intuitive mode operation that operate non-hierarchically, that share information, that have distributed control, that can operate rapidly, and they have an operating culture that's openly evolved by peer review, managed for the general good rather than extracting profit from proprietary structures. Linux, for instance, in a two-year period, going from Red Hat 6.2 to 7.1, produced an estimated $1 billion of software development, entirely distributed on the Internet by people just working together, trying to produce a common shared culture. Usenet and WWW is a similar distributed ways of organizing people. And I think we often don't bring this one up, but just the way scientific progress works. People don't own what it is that they come up with. They share their results. There's peer review. It operates by consensus. And so just finally, the last slide, looping back to Einstein again, we'll let him explain what he thought by this other way of thinking. A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. So, in conclusion, I would like to encourage a conversation as to how we can get these other modes more vital and more active in our businesses and in our society. So thank you for coming. Any questions or anything? I'm happy to chat.